Then Hubbard arrives at a level that preoccupies him, 1.1 on the tone scale. Here is the harlot, the pervert, the unfaithful wife, free love, easy marriage and quick divorce, and general sexual disaster, he writes. A society which reaches this level is on its way out of history. A mother who is at 1.1 on the tone scale will attempt to abort her child. However, once the child is born, we get general neglect and thoughtlessness about the child and no feeling whatsoever about the child's future or any effort to build one for it. We get careless familial actions such as promiscuity, which will tear to pieces the family security upon which this child's future depends. Along this band, the child is considered a thing, a possession. Hubbard finished the book and wrote this dedication. To Alexis Valerie Hubbard, for whose tomorrow may be hoped a world that is fit to be free. Hubbard eventually wrote a note to Sarah to explain his whereabouts, saying that he was in a Cuban military hospital about to be transferred to the States as a classified scientist immune from interference of all kinds. He adds, I will be hospitalized probably a long time. Alexis is getting excellent care. I see her every day. She is all I have to live for. My wits never gave way under all you did and let them do, but my body didn't stand up. My right side is paralyzed. I hope my heart lasts. Dianetics will last 10,000 years, for the Army and Navy have it now. He concludes by warning that in the event of his death, Alexis will inherit a fortune, but if Sarah gains custody, the child will get nothing. Hubbard did return to the United States and hunkered down in Wichita, Kansas, where a wealthy supporter, Don Purcell, provided him sanctuary. Hubbard's old friend Russell Hayes was there, consulting for the Cessna Aircraft Corporation. Hubbard arrived with a Cadillac so damn long he couldn't hardly park it anywhere, and two concubines, Hayes marveled. When Sarah discovered where her husband was, she sought to enjoin his assets. Hubbard retaliated by writing a letter to the U.S. Attorney General, explaining the peril he was in. I am basically a scientist in the field of atomic and molecular phenomena, he said by way of introduction. He said that his own investigation showed that Sarah was tied to communists who had infiltrated the Dianetics Foundation. This was at the height of McCarthyism and the Red Scare. I did not realize my wife was one until this spring, Hubbard wrote. He named several of his disaffected followers, including Gregory Hemingway, son of the famous novelist. When will we have a roundup? He implored. Meantime, Sarah came to Wichita to pursue the divorce and to get Alexis back. Ron blithely suggested that they should take a trip together. He told me that I was under the influence of this communist cell, run by her husband, Sarah recalled, and that they were dictating to me what to do, and that I was in a state of complete madness. I told him, yep, I think you're right. The only thing I can do is to work through it and do whatever they say. Ron replied that the communists had hypnotized her. Sarah played along but insisted she would have to go through the divorce. Only then would she be able to break free of their power. You know, I'm a public figure and you're nobody, Ron said. So if you have to go through the divorce, I'll accuse you of desertion so it won't look so bad on my public record. As long as she was going to get Alexis back as part of the bargain, Sarah agreed. On the day of the divorce, Ron was convinced that the spell the communists had cast over Sarah would be broken, and she would come back to him. When they walked out of the courtroom, Sarah told him that she had to get their daughter. Ron took her to the place where Alexis was being held. Sarah said that the last thing she had to do was go to the airport. She already had a ticket. Then the enchantment would dissolve, and she would be free. On the day of her scheduled departure, Ron drove Sarah and Alexis to the airport. "We got halfway there, and he said he wasn't going to do it," Sarah recalled. "You're going to get on that plane and go away, aren't you?" Ron said. "Well, I have to follow their dictates," Sarah replied. "I'll just go to the airplane." Ron parked the car. He told her that he couldn't stand the idea that she would be under the influence of psychiatrists and that he might never see either of them again. "I'm not going to let you go," he said. "I got out of the car. It was on the edge of the airfield," Sarah remembered. "I left all Alexei's clothes in the car. I left my suitcase. One of her shoes fell off, and I had my purse. I just ran across the airfield, across the runways, to the airport, and got on the plane. And it was the 19th of June, and it was the happiest day of my life." In the space of a year, Hubbard had gone from destitution and obscurity to great wealth and international renown, followed by a crashing descent. The foundation he had created to train auditors plummeted into debt and soon declared bankruptcy. Close supporters such as John Campbell and Dr. Winter deserted. Dianetics proved to be a fad that had swept the country, infatuating tens or even hundreds of thousands of people, but then burned itself out more quickly than the hula hoop. Once again, Hubbard got a house trailer, and this time he drove it to Lawrence, Kansas, where Russell Hayes now lived. Hayes instructed Hubbard to park his trailer on some raw land he owned nearby. "That didn't please him," Hayes said. "I wouldn't want to have to live with him. He'd get on my nerves." Hubbard was drinking and had a number of drugs along with him, and he pressed Hayes to supply him with marijuana. Hayes later dried some horseweed and mailed it to Hubbard, signing the letter, "I am Reefer." Hayes advised the discouraged Hubbard to make use of his extensive mailing list. There were many followers who still believed in the man and his method. Some had had meaningful emotional breakthroughs. Others had experiences, such as leaving their bodies, that conclusively proved to them the validity of Hubbard's claims. These acolytes provided the bedrock of support that Hubbard needed to regenerate his broken organization, rebuild his finances, and repair the stain on his reputation caused by his personal scandals. In addition to Hubbard's relentless self-confidence, several new factors salvaged his movement. He had a new device, the E-meter, developed by one of his followers, which Hubbard revealed in March 1952. The E-meter would replace the Dianetic reverie with what appeared to be a more scientific approach, one that didn't look so much like a hypnotic trance. "It sees all, knows all," Hubbard declared. "It is never wrong." And he had a new wife, Mary Sue Whip, a petite Texan, 20 years his junior, whom he married that same month. She was already pregnant with the first of their four children. Hubbard also had a new name for his movement. From now on, it was Scientology. Chapter 3. Going Overboard. Given his biography, it would be easy to dismiss Hubbard as a fraud, but that would fail to explain his total absorption in his project. He would spend the rest of his life elaborating his theory and, even more obsessively, constructing the intricate bureaucracy designed to spread and enshrine his visionary understanding of human behavior. His life narrowed down to his singular mission. Each passageway in his interior expedition led him deeper into his imagination. That journey became Scientology, a totalistic universe in which his every turn was mapped and described. Hubbard's own logic was inclining him toward conclusions that he was at first reluctant to draw. By admitting the validity of prenatal memories, he was bound to confront a dilemma. What if the memories didn't stop there? When patients began having sperm dreams, Hubbard had to accept the idea that prenatal engrams were recorded as early as shortly before conception. Then, when patients began to remember previous lives, Hubbard resisted the idea. It threatened to tear apart his organization. The subject of past deaths and past lives is so full of tension that as early as last July 1950, the Board of Trustees of the Dianetics Foundation sought to pass a resolution banning the entire subject, he confided. Still, the implications were intriguing. What if we have lived before? Might there be memories that occasionally leak through into present time? Wouldn't that prove that we are immortal beings, only temporarily residing in our present incarnations? Instead of remembering, the patient undergoing Dianetic counseling returns to the past life event. There is a different feel to another period in time that's so basic it's hard to describe, Hubbard's top U.S. executive, Helen O'Brien, recalled. If you find yourself in a room, there may be color with unfamiliar tones because of gaslight shining on it. The air has a strange quality. Its particles of dust derive from unmodern constituents. Even human bodies seem to radiate a different kind of warmth when they are covered with the fabrics of another age. Memory, per se, filters out all that. When you return, you find the past intact. Some of the returnings were shocking or painful. O'Brien's first past life experience in an auditing session was that of being a young Irish woman in the early 19th century. She could feel the coarse texture of her full-skirted dress as she walked down a narrow country lane, hearing the birds and feeling the warm country air. But when she turned a corner of her house, she saw a British soldier bayoneting her 14-year-old son in the yard. "I literally shuddered with grief," O'Brien writes. When the soldier threw her to the ground and tried to rape her, she spit in his face. He crushed her skull with a cobblestone. O'Brien's auditor had her re-experience the scene over and over until she was able to move through the entire bloody tableau unaffected. "By the end of it, I was luxuriously comfortable in every fiber," she writes. "When I walked downstairs, the electric lights dazzled me. The clean, modern lines of the house interior and the furniture were elegant and strange to me beyond all description. I was freshly there from another age. For the first time in this lifetime, I knew I was beyond the laws of space and time. I was never the same again." With his new acceptance of past life experiences, Hubbard could now describe the individual as being divisible into three parts. First, there was the spirit, or soul, which Hubbard calls the thetan. The thetan normally lives in or near a body, but can also be entirely separate from it. When a person goes exterior, for instance, it is the thetan part of him that travels outside the body or views himself from across the room. The mind, which serves mainly as a storehouse of pictures, functions as a communication and control system for the thetan, helping him operate in his environment. The body is merely the physical composition of the person existing in space and time. Anyone who stands in the way of a thetan's spiritual progress is a suppressive person, SP. This is a key concept in Scientology. Hubbard uses the term to describe a sociopath. The suppressive instinctively fights against constructive forces and is driven berserk by those who try to help others. Hubbard estimates that suppressives constitute about 20% of the population, but only about 2.5% are truly dangerous. A suppressive person will goof up or vilify any effort to help anybody, and particularly knife with violence anything calculated to make human beings more powerful or more intelligent, Hubbard writes. The artist in particular is often found as a magnet for persons with antisocial personalities who see in his art something which must be destroyed. Naturally, anyone who is close to a suppressive person is in great danger of falling under his influence. Hubbard called that person a potential trouble source. If, for instance, a parent opposes a child who wants to join Scientology, that parent is likely to be declared an SP. And as long as the child remains in contact with the parent, he is in danger of being defined as a PTS. He will be denied auditing and training. Eventually, the child will have to make a choice, either to leave the church, which offers him a path to career success, personal improvement, and salvation, or to disconnect from his parent, who is the cause of his failure to achieve happiness and realize his dreams. Hubbard had learned some difficult lessons from his experience with Dianetics. He was by nature an autocrat, but his work beckoned to amateurs. The movement inspired by his book had sprung up so quickly there was no real chance to rein it in and exert the kind of authority that might have made it more durable. Although he tried to impose order by creating professional training schools for auditors, in truth, he had more or less surrendered control of the movement from the moment of inception by empowering his readers to become practitioners themselves. All they had to do was follow the formulas sketched in his book. Entrepreneurs grabbed hold of the concept and snatched it out of his hands. They spread the message, but they also diluted it. When the Dianetics movement subsided, Hubbard was unable to restore the momentum that had given it such a rocket-powered launch. Imitators and competitors came onto the field, some even rivaling Hubbard himself. He was determined not to make the same mistakes with Scientology. From now on, he would exercise total control. His word was law. He was not just the founder, he was source. The last word, whose every pronouncement was scripture. In the evolution of Dianetics to Scientology, however, there was a larger wheel turning inside Hubbard's protean imagination. Until now, religion had played little or no part in his life or his thought, except perhaps as it was reflected in the cynical remark he is reported to have made on a number of occasions, "I'd like to start a religion. That's where the money is." One of the problems with Dianetics from a money-making perspective was the lack of a long-term association on the part of its adherents. Psychotherapy has a theoretical conclusion to it. The patient is cured, or decides that the procedure doesn't work for him. In either case, the revenue dries up. Religion solves that problem. In addition to tax advantages, religion supplies a commodity that is always in demand: salvation. Hubbard ingeniously developed Scientology into a series of veiled revelations, each of which promised greater abilities and increased spiritual power. "To keep a person on the Scientology path," Hubbard once told one of his associates, "feed him a mystery sandwich." It may be true that his decision to take his movement in a new direction had more to do with the legal and tax advantages that accrue to religious organizations than it did with actual spiritual inspiration. He was desperate for money. The branches of his Dianetics Foundation were shuttered one after another. At one point, Hubbard even lost the rights to the name Dianetics. The trend for his movement was toward disaster. A letter Hubbard wrote to one of his executives in 1953 shows him weighing the advantages of setting up a new organization. "Perhaps we could call it a spiritual guidance center," he speculates, "and we could put in nice desks and our boys in neat blue with diplomas on the walls, and 1, knock psychotherapy into history, and 2, make enough money to shine up my operating scope, and 3, keep the HAS, Hubbard Association of Scientologists, solvent. It is a problem of practical business." I await your reaction on the religion angle. In the anti-Scientology narrative, this is one of several clear statements of Hubbard's calculations and proof that the church was nothing more than a money-making front. But Hubbard follows this with the observation, we're treating present-time beingness. Psychotherapy treats the past and the brain.
And brother, that's religion, not mental science. At the end of that year, Hubbard incorporated three different churches, the Church of American Science, the Church of Spiritual Engineering, and the eventual winner in the brand name contest, the Church of Scientology. The Church of Scientology of California was established on February 18, 1954, quickly followed by another in Washington, D.C. The fields of psychotherapy and religion have bled into each other on many occasions. They have in common the goal of reshaping one's view of the world and letting go of, or actually renouncing, one's previous stance. Footnote. Harriet Whitehead, an anthropologist who conducted fieldwork in Scientology in the United States and the United Kingdom between 1969 and 1971, writes of the fundamental kinship between psychotherapy and religion. The cosmological system that surrounds a renunciatory discipline cannot for long remain secular, that is, finite and this-worldly, in its orientation, she writes. This is one of the reasons secular therapeutic doctrines often develop a religious or mystical cast. Although Freud was a non-religious Jew, the techniques of analysis he developed may have had their roots in certain mystical practices rooted in the Kabbalah, such as the interpretation of dreams and the use of free association to uncover hidden motivations. Jung subsequently steered psychoanalysis into deeply spiritual waters, a course, as Whitehead points out, that parallels the evolution of Dianetics into Scientology. It would thus be facile to dismiss the promulgation of a quasi-empirical supernaturalism in the Dianetics movement as simply the product of amateur theorizing by a spinner of tales, when Hubbard's predecessors who established the framework within which psychotherapy, amateur and otherwise, would subsequently develop, did hardly any better. Whitehead, Renunciation and Reformulation, pages 27 and 8. End of footnote. Hubbard said there were many, many reasons to ally Scientology with religion. To some, this seems mere opportunism, he later admitted to a reporter. To some, it would seem that Scientology is simply making itself bulletproof in the eyes of the law. Among the many other incentives to turn Hubbard's movement into a religion, there is one that might be considered, especially in light of the frequent charge that he was insane. Religion is always an irrational enterprise, no matter how ennobling it may be to the human spirit. In many cultures, people who might be considered mentally ill in Western societies are thought of as religious healers or shamans. Anthropologists have called schizophrenia the shaman's sickness, because part of a shaman's traditional journey requires suffering an illness that cannot be cured except by spiritual means. The shaman uses the powers and insights he gains from his experience to heal his community. This is exactly the history that Hubbard paints as his own, a blind cripple in the Navy hospital, given up for lost, who then heals himself through techniques he refines into Dianetics. This is the gift he humbly offers as a means of healing humanity. The goal of Dianetics is a sane world, a world without insanity, without criminals, and without war, he declares. It can be stopped only by the insane. For both the shaman and the schizophrenic, the boundaries between reality and illusion are soft, and consciousness slips easily from one to the other. Hubbard, with his highly imaginative mind, certainly had immediate access to visionary worlds. His science fiction stories are evidence of that. But it is a different matter to be able to cast the nets of one's imagination into the unconscious and pull out best-selling books. The schizophrenic is rarely so productive in the material world. Sometimes in Hubbard's writings, however, he puts forward what appear to be fantasies of a highly schizophrenic personality. In 1952, for instance, he began talking about injected entities, which can paralyze portions of the anatomy or block information from being audited. These entities can be located in the body, always in the same places. For instance, one of the entities, the crew chief, is found on the right side of the jaw down to the shoulder. They are the mysterious voices in the heads of some pre-clears, Hubbard said. Paralysis, anxiety stomachs, arthritis, and many ills and aberrations have been relieved by auditing them. An e-meter shows them up and makes them confess their misdeeds. They are probably just compartments of the mind which, cut off, begin to act as though they were persons. Hubbard says there are actually two separate genetic lines that, in the history of evolution, first came together in the mollusk, but have been contending for dominance ever since, even in human beings. In the bivalve state, one finds them at war with each other in an effort to attain sole command of the entire bivalve, Hubbard writes. This primordial contest manifests itself in higher forms of life, in such things as right and left-handedness. Your discussion of these incidents with the uninitiated in Scientology can produce havoc, Hubbard warns. Should you describe the clam to someone, you may re-stimulate him to the point of causing severe jaw hinge pain. One such victim, after hearing about a clam death, could not use his jaws for 3 days. Hubbard's third wife was smart and poised, a decorous partner for him. She was so slight and weightless that it might be easy to overlook her, but her southern manners and Texas accent concealed a hard and determined nature. Unlike Sarah or Polly, Mary Sue was a true believer, a natural enforcer. One of Hubbard's executives later described her as pragmatic, cold, cunning, calculating, efficient, and fiercely loyal. She had flinty blue eyes, a sharp, prominent nose, and a rare lopsided smile that would expose her uneven, slightly crossed front teeth. Ron and Mary Sue, with their burgeoning family, began a restless search for a new home, for themselves and for the international headquarters of the church. In 1955, they moved to Washington, D.C., but they stayed only a few months before moving to London. Less than 2 years later, they were back in Washington, living in a dignified brownstone near DuPont Circle, across the street from the Academy of Scientology. Hubbard was prospering once again, with mounting commissions from the sale of e-meters and training processes, and royalties from 60 books in print. In 1956, his salary from the church was only $500 a month, but the following year, the church began paying him a percentage of its gross profits, and his income took a gigantic leap. In Washington, Hubbard set up visiting hours from 4 to 6 every afternoon and made a point of warning the pilgrims who trod the path to his door not to mistake him for a god or a guru, so knock off the idolizing. And yet he couldn't resist exaggerating his status. Identifying himself as a nuclear physicist, Hubbard published a book in 1957, All About Radiation, in which he promoted a formula he called dianazine, a mixture of nicotinic acid and vitamins that was supposed to cure cancer as well as sunburns. It should be taken daily, he recommended, with milk and chocolate. Ron and Mary Sue had 4 children in 6 years. Diana, born in 1952, was the eldest and clearly the dominant one. She had her father's red hair and a generous splattering of freckles. Quentin, born 2 years later, was the only one who was not a radiant redhead. He was small, with ash blonde hair, like Mary Sue, and would always be his mother's favorite. Suzette was a year younger. She was a cheerful child, but somewhat overshadowed by her big sister. The baby, Arthur, was born in 1958. Seen together, the Hubbard family made a vivid impression with their ruddy complexions and their striking hair color. Although the children had a nanny, they spent much of their time unsupervised. School was an afterthought. It wasn't until Diana demanded to learn how to write her name that the children began their education. Mary Sue was a chilly presence as a mother. She rarely cuddled or even touched her children, but in the early years she would read to them Mary Poppins, Winnie the Pooh, and Kipling's stories in her slight Texas twang. As she took on additional responsibility in Scientology, she became even more removed. But Ron would hug the kids and toss them in the air. The house echoed with his booming laugh. He taught the children how to play chopsticks on the piano and showed them card tricks with his quick hands and perfectly manicured fingernails. He would play records and dance with the children to Beethoven or Ravel or Edvard Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite. Bold, soaring music. He liked to sing, and he would burst into Farewell and Adieu to You Fair Spanish Ladies, and Be Kind to Your Web-Footed Friends, a children's song that is sung to the tune of The Stars and Stripes Forever. He was fanatical about taking vitamins, and he made sure the children took theirs as well. Afterward, they would all roar to see who was the strongest. Hubbard was restless in Washington, and in 1959 he moved his family back to England to a luxurious estate in Sussex called St. Hill Manor, which he purchased from the Maharaja of Jaipur. Hubbard employed an extensive household staff, including two butlers, a housekeeper, a nanny, a tutor for the children, a chauffeur, and maintenance workers for the estate. Dr. Hubbard presented himself to the curious British press as an experimental horticultural scientist. To prove it, he allowed a photograph to be published of himself staring intently at a tomato that was attached to an e-meter. The headline in Garden News was, "Plants Do Worry and Feel Pain." The Grand Mansion was a terrific playground for the children. It was actually a U-shaped castle with crenellated rooflines, ivy-covered walls, and rumors of ghosts. There were 52 rolling acres to play in, with rose gardens, goldfish ponds, and a lake. The house itself had sweeping staircases, elevators, and even secret rooms where the children could hide from the nanny. The children also prowled through their mother's closet. Left to herself, Mary Sue was an indifferent dresser, but Ron brought tailors from London carrying gorgeous bolts of cloth and racks of clothing brought in from the top department stores, all in Mary Sue's size. Her closet was full of sparkling gowns and shimmering dresses. Trim and regal by nature, Mary Sue was a wonderful model, but she really only dressed for him. Hubbard's third-floor research room was the enticing inner sanctum. It was painted royal blue, with a bare rug in front of the fireplace, and a private bathroom that was redolent of the Spanish sandalwood soap he favored. Hubbard would disappear into his office every day for hours and hours, alone with his e-meter, mapping out the bank and looking for the next undercut, as he explained, meaning that he was trying to inventory the reactive mind and discover a path through its many snares. School was, as usual, a secondary consideration. The children would take a taxi to class when they actually went. Their father didn't really believe in public education, so he didn't pressure them. Sometimes they had a tutor, but it was Diana who taught Suzette how to read. She didn't want Suzette to suffer the same embarrassment she had when she started school so far behind her peers. By the age of 9, Suzette was reading adult literature. She decided she wanted to be a writer like her father. Quentin developed an obsession with airplanes, and he would often persuade the nanny or the chauffeur to take him to Gatwick Airport instead of to class, so he could watch the various aircraft taking off and landing. He loved to stand near the runway with the heavy planes lumbering just overhead. He was soon able to close his eyes and identify the make of the plane strictly by its sound. In school, other children would ask the older Hubbard kids about their father and what was going on in the castle. They realized that they didn't actually know. One day, Diana, Quentin, and Suzette marched into Hubbard's office and demanded, "What is this Scientology?" Hubbard put them all on a starter Dianetics course. Scientology was in its formative stage, still unfurling from Hubbard's imaginative mind. This was a volatile moment in Hubbard's life and the development of his movement. The fervent response of so many to his revelations must have added reality and substance to what otherwise might have seemed mere fantasies. Not only was he inventing a new religion, he was also reinventing himself as a religious leader. He was creating the legend of who he was in the minds of those who believed in him. And inevitably, he became imprisoned by their expectations. His followers lived in a state of constant anticipation, trading legends among themselves about the marvels they had experienced or heard about, and speculating upon what was to come. Moments of magic and transcendence kept reason at bay. Ken Urquhart, who served as Hubbard's butler and later as his secretary, or communicator, recalls coaching a little old English lady on a Scientology training exercise. As he observed her, "I noticed her nice skin, her eyes, eyebrows. I noted that behind the skin on her forehead was the bone of her forehead, and I knew that behind that lay her brain. As I thought that thought, her forehead absolutely disappeared. I was looking directly at her brain. I was first astounded and then quickly horrified. Here I was exposing her brain to germs and the cold. At once her forehead was back in place." If Scientology really did bestow enhanced powers upon its adherents, Hubbard himself, of all people, should be able to exercise them. Hubbard's frailties were obvious to everyone. Among other things, his hands shook from palsy, and he was hard of hearing, constantly exclaiming, "What? What?" He sensed the presumptions that surrounded him. "Your friends," he said one day to Urquhart as his bath was being prepared, "might be curious as to why I employ somebody to open the shutters in my room when I can do it myself." He meant that he should be able, by sheer mental power, to project his intention and the shutters would open themselves. "Well, a lot of people would like me to appear in the sky over New York so as to impress the world. But if I were to do that, I'd overwhelm a lot of people. I'm not here to overwhelm." Urquhart thought of saying that he was perfectly willing to be overwhelmed in order to see such a demonstration, but he wasn't altogether sure that Hubbard could actually do it. The failure of Hubbard's followers to challenge him made them complicit in the creation of the mythical figure that he became. They conspired to protect the image of L. Ron Hubbard, the prophet, the revelator, and the friend of mankind. On the other hand, there were moments when Hubbard seemed to be toying with the limits of possibility. It was rumored that he could move the clouds around in the sky or stir up dust devils in his wake. Urquhart remembers a time when Hubbard was talking to him while sitting in a chair more than an arm's length away. "My attention wandered," he recalled. "Suddenly he felt a finger poking him in the ribs. I came back. He was talking away, grinning and eyes twinkling. He had not moved his arms or gotten up from the chair." Such ineffable experiences seemed to add up to something, although it was not clear what that might be. Hubbard's neighbors soon learned more about the new lord of the manor. Scientology's expansion, coupled with the increasingly bold claims that Hubbard made about the health benefits that could be expected, brought the organization under scrutiny by various governments. The first blow was a 1963 raid by U.S. Marshals, acting on a warrant issued by the Food and Drug Administration to seize more than 100 e-meters stored in the Washington Church. The FDA charged that the labeling for the e-meter suggested that it was effective in diagnosing and treating all mental and nervous disorders and illnesses, as well as psychosomatic ailments of mankind such as arthritis, cancer, stomach ulcers, and radiation burns from atomic bombs, poliomyelitis, the common cold, etc. Footnote. A federal district court eventually allowed e-meters to be used for bona fide religious counseling, but ordered that each device bear a warning that the e-meter is not medically or scientifically useful for the diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of any disease. It is not medically or scientifically capable of improving the health or bodily functions of anyone. Amended Order of U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, number 71-2064, March 1, 1973. End footnote. The IRS began an audit that would strip the church of its religious tax exemption in 1967. At the same time, an Australian government board of inquiry produced a sweeping report that was passionate in its condemnation. There are some features of Scientology which are so ludicrous that there may be a tendency to regard Scientology as silly and its practitioners as harmless cranks. To do so would be gravely to misunderstand the tenor of the board's conclusions, the report began, then emphatically added, Scientology is evil, its techniques evil, its practice a serious threat to the community, medically, morally, and socially, and its adherents sadly deluded and often mentally ill. The report admitted that there were transient gains realized by some of the religion's adherents, but said that the organization plays on those gains in order to produce a subservience amounting almost to mental enslavement. As for Hubbard himself, the board described him as a man of restless energy who is constantly experimenting and speculating, and equally constantly he confuses the two. Some of his claims are that he has been up in the Van Allen belt, that he has been on the planet Venus, where he inspected an implant station, and that he has been to heaven. He even recommends a protein formula for feeding non-breastfed babies, a mixture of boiled barley and corn syrup, stating that he picked it up in Roman days. Although Hubbard has an insensate hostility to psychiatrists and people in the field of mental health, the report noted, he is himself mentally abnormal, evincing a persecution complex and an imposing aggregation of symptoms which, in psychiatric circles, are strongly indicative of a condition of paranoid schizophrenia with delusions of grandeur, symptoms common to dictators. The report led to a ban of Scientology in two Australian states. The ban was repealed in 1973, and prompted similar inquiries in New Zealand, Britain, and South Africa. Hubbard believed that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, along with the FBI and CIA, were feeding slanderous information about the church to various governments. In the midst of all this upheaval, in February 1966, Hubbard finally declared another first clear. This time it was John McMaster, a dapper blonde South African in his mid-30s, who was the director of the Hubbard Guidance Center at the church's St. Hill headquarters. Charming, ascetic, and well-spoken, McMaster had dropped out of medical school to become an auditor. He immediately proved to be a far more urbane representative of Scientology than Hubbard. His wry manner made him a welcome guest on talk shows and on the lecture circuit, where he portrayed Scientology as a cool and non-threatening route to self-realization. Suddenly, the idea of going clear began to catch on. McMaster adopted a clerical outfit that befitted his designation as the church's unofficial ambassador to the United Nations. At one point, Hubbard designated him Scientology's first pope. It was a matter of puzzlement to Hubbard's closest associates, given Hubbard's disparagement of homosexuals in his books, that he would enlist a person to serve as the church's representative who was obviously gay. He was very pronounced in his affect, one of Hubbard's medical officers remembered, but Hubbard's relationship to homosexuality was apparently more complicated in life than in theory. Convinced that the British, American, and Soviet governments were interested in gaining control of Scientology's secrets in order to use them for evil intentions, Hubbard began looking for a safe harbor, ideally a country that he could rule over. England had taken steps to curb the growth of Scientology, and Hubbard took the hint. He also suffered from the damp weather. I had been ill with pneumonia for the third time in England, and on the suggestion of my doctor, was seeking a warmer climate for a short while in order to recover, he said in an unprompted explanation to the CIA. He resigned as executive director of the Church of Scientology and sold his interests in the Hubbard Association of Scientologists International, although he maintained actual control of the organization through his innumerable telexes. He journeyed to Rhodesia, the South African republic that had recently declared its independence from the United Kingdom. It later became Zimbabwe. Isolated, diplomatically spurned, and subject to international sanctions, the Rhodesian government served a clique of white colonists who ruled over an insurgent black majority. To Hubbard, Rhodesia seemed ripe for a takeover. He felt a kinship with the Republic's dashing and flamboyant founder, Cecil John Rhodes, who also had red hair and a taste for swashbuckling adventure. Hubbard believed he might have been Rhodes in a previous life, although it's unclear whether he knew that Rhodes was homosexual. Hubbard had a fantasy that he would be welcomed in Rhodesia, that the black population would embrace him like a brother, and that eventually he would become its leader, issuing passports and his own currency. However, the current Prime Minister, Ian Smith, was desperately trying to negotiate a settlement with the black nationalist movement that would preserve white minority rule. Hubbard thoughtfully wrote up a constitution for the government that he claimed would accomplish just that, but he couldn't get anyone to take it seriously. While Hubbard talked about his big plans for developing the country, the government became increasingly suspicious of his motives and his resources. Ultimately, Hubbard's visa was not renewed. "He told me Ian Smith was going to be shot because he was a suppressive," John McMaster said. The real reason that Hubbard was kicked out of Rhodesia was that his checks bounced. Hubbard returned to England with a new scheme. If the world's governments were lining up against him, he would put himself beyond reach. Scientologists were whispering about a clandestine sea project that their leader was planning. He quietly began acquiring a small fleet of ocean-going vessels. Then he disappeared again. This time he went to Tangier, the Moroccan city on the Strait of Gibraltar, which was a famous hangout for hipsters and artists. There he began his research on Operating Thetan Level 3, OT3, his Wall of Fire. Mary Sue and the children remained in England, but Hubbard wrote to her daily, complaining of a barking dog that was interrupting his work and various ailments, a bad back and a lung problem that emerged from a lingering cold. He admitted that he was drinking lots of rum and taking drugs, pinks and grays, while he was doing his research. He would sign off on the letters, "Your Shuggy." Hubbard stayed only a month in Tangier before moving to Las Palmas in the Canary Islands, where one of his followers found him deeply depressed and surrounded by pills of all kinds. "I want to die," he said. Alarmed, Mary Sue flew down to take care of him. In September 1967, Hubbard made a recording for his followers to explain his absence and inform them of important discoveries in his OT3 research. "All this recent career has been relatively hard on this poor body," he relates. "I've broken its back, broken its knee, and now I have a broken arm because of the strenuousness of these particular adventures. One wonders then, well, if he is in such good shape, what is he doing breaking up his body? Well, that is the trouble. I have great difficulty getting down to the small power level of a body." He also notes that he had directed Mary Sue to find out who was behind the attacks on Scientology that were turning the governments against the organization. Mary Sue had hired several professional intelligence agents who uncovered a conspiracy. "Our enemies on this planet are less than 12 men," Hubbard discloses. "They own and control newspaper chains, and they are, oddly enough, directors in all the mental health groups in the world. Their plan was to use mental health, which is to say psychiatric electric shock and prefrontal lobotomy, to remove from their path any political dissenters." For the first time, he openly talks about the Sea Organization, or Sea Org, an elite group who would form the committed inner core of the religion, Hubbard's disciples, a Scientology clergy. Hannah Strachan, now Hannah Eltringham Whitfield, was one of the first young recruits admitted into the Sea Org. Her deranged and manipulative mother was a follower of Helena Blavatsky, the 19th-century spiritualist who was the founder of the Theosophical Society. When Hannah was about 15, she learned that Blavatsky had prophesied a new race that would arise in the Americas in the 1950s. Hannah was under the impression that it would be led by a man with red hair. Hannah escaped her traumatic family situation to become a nurse in Johannesburg, South Africa. A medical student there gave her a copy of Dianetics. It made immediate sense to her. She went to the local organization and said she wanted to learn more. "There's a course starting tonight," she was told. In the hallway of the office, Hannah noticed a photograph of Hubbard standing outside the St. Hill headquarters. She was transfixed by his red hair. "This must be the man Blavatsky was talking about," she decided. "That sealed it for me," she said. She moved to St. Hill and became Clear Number 60. For 3 weeks, she was in a state of euphoria, feeling slightly detached from her environment and her body. "This is who we were in eons past," she thought. She was convinced that Hubbard was a returned savior who would bring all humanity to an enlightened state. Slender and stately, Hannah was one of the first 35 Sea Org recruits. The mission of the Sea Org, according to the contract she signed, is to get ethics in on this planet and the universe. She agreed to subscribe to the discipline, mores, and conditions of this group. "Therefore, I contract myself to the Sea Organization for the next billion years." Footnote. According to the Church, the first Sea Organization members formulated a 1 billion-year pledge to symbolize their eternal commitment to the religion, and it is still signed by all members today. It is a symbolic document which, similar to vows of dedication in other faiths and orders, serves to signify an individual's eternal commitment to the goals, purposes, and principles of the Scientology religion. End of footnote. Hannah married another Sea Org member, an American named Guy Eltringham, but they were separated when Hubbard ordered her to Las Palmas, where he was refitting an exhausted fishing trawler called the Avon River. The decks and the hold were coated with decades of fish oil that had to be scraped away. During the 2 months the Avon River was in dry dock, Hubbard would often linger for dinner with his Sea Org crew, and afterward he would sit on the deck and regale them with stories. Hubbard's depression had lifted, and he seemed completely in control, relaxed and confident, even jovial. The crew were mainly drinking Spanish wines, but Hubbard favored rum and coke, an eighth of a glass of coke and seven-eighths rum, one after another through the evening. The heavens seemed very close in the dark harbor. Hubbard would point to the sky and say, "That is where the fifth invaders came from. They're the bad guys. They're the ones who put us here." He said he could actually spot their spaceships crossing in front of the stars, and he would salute them as they passed overhead just to let them know that they had been seen. During a session with her auditor, Hannah revealed the story of Madame Blavatsky's prophecy of the red-haired man. Soon afterward, Hubbard came up on deck and gave her an intense look. From that point on, she became his favorite. He appointed her the first female Sea Org lieutenant. That day, she had a photograph made of herself in her Sea Org uniform, white shirt, dark tie and jacket, with a lanyard over one shoulder. She is young and elegant, her blonde hair pulled back in a ponytail. After that, she rose through the Sea Org ranks with astonishing speed, often wondering if the revelation about the red-haired man was responsible for her rapid promotions. Hubbard would drive over from his villa in Las Palmas to inspect the work on the Avon River. The lower holds of the ship were converted into offices and berthing spaces. New equipment, including radar and a gyro compass, were installed, the screw replaced, and the hydraulic system completely overhauled. The inexperienced Sea Org members did most of the work, although Spanish laborers did the welding and sandblasting. Whenever Hubbard spotted something wrong, he would be instantly transformed from the jovial and avuncular figure the crew adored into a raging, implacable tyrant. Hannah, who was serving as master-at-arms, would dread seeing the Commodore, as Hubbard titled himself, arrive, since she felt responsible if anything went wrong. One day, when the Spanish workmen were painting a rust coat on the hull of the ship, she spotted Hubbard walking across the beach with his chief officer and his first mate, smoking and chatting happily. Then he suddenly stopped. His eyes went into slits, and he began bellowing, "The rollers! The rollers!" Puzzled, Hannah leaned over the side of the ship, then saw what had caught Hubbard's attention, tiny threads poking through the paint, which had been left by the cheap rollers that the workmen were using. As those threads decomposed, they would leave little apertures for seawater to leak behind the rust coating, she realized. It destroyed the integrity of the entire rust coating, and that's what Hubbard was screaming about as he lumbered toward the ship. And what amazed me was that he saw it at 40 to 60 feet away from the ship. Later on, I walked that distance from the ship to see if I could see those little hairs coming out of the rust coat. There was no way I could see them. That added to my feeling of wonder and mystique about Hubbard. In truth, Hubbard had very poor eyesight. Before the war, both the Naval Academy and the Naval Reserve had rejected him because of his vision, and all during the war he wore glasses. In 1951, when he was being evaluated for a medical disability, his vision tested at 20/200 for each eye, correctable to 20/20 with glasses, much the same as it had been before the war. The examiner noted, "Eyes tire easily, has worn all types of glasses, but claims he sees just as well without as with glasses." Was that even possible? Eyesight does change over the years, but Hubbard's eyes were astigmatic, meaning they were more football-shaped than round, and not likely to have improved, certainly not dramatically. And yet many of Hubbard's associates testify to his keen eyesight. Without glasses, Hubbard would have been legally blind. Perhaps that's what he was referring to when he said he had cured himself of blindness after the war. but clearly his eye examination showed different results. Hubbard had written in Dianetics that the eyesight of a clear gradually improves to optimum perception. And yet, he admitted elsewhere that his vision was so bad in the post-war years that he could scarcely see his typewriter to write. He wore glasses and early versions of contact lenses. Through the use of Dianetic processing, he says, his eyes began to change. Many noticed that Hubbard had a habit of squinting, which has the effect of pressing astigmatic eyeballs into a rounder shape, which might momentarily improve his vision. He theorized that astigmatism, a distortion of image, is only an anxiety to alter the image. One day, for instance, he was reading an American Medical Association report and couldn't make it out at all. He thought he might have to resort to using a magnifying glass. Then he realized that the reason he couldn't read it was that he wasn't willing to confront what it said. I threw it aside, picked up a novel, and the print was perfect. Hubbard would sometimes chastise members of his crew about their dependence on eyeglasses, which he said were an admission of overts, transgressions against the group. One night, as the fleet was sailing in the Caribbean, he looked at the young woman serving him dinner, Tracy Ekstrand, whose glasses were sliding down her nose in the tropical heat. "You're doing yourself an aesthetic disservice," he pronounced. She was mortified and stopped wearing glasses that night. Although she was still able to move from room to room and serve meals, her vision remained quite blurred. Some weeks later, as Hubbard was retiring for the night, he looked at her again. He held up his pack of cigarettes a foot in front of her face and asked if she could read the bold capital letters, "Cool." Flustered by the personal attention from the Commodore, Ekstrand mumbled the name of the cigarettes. "There's been a shift," he declared triumphantly, then went to bed. Ekstrand was shaken. "I remained outside his door for some minutes, dumbfounded and unsure how to react," she recalled. "This time there was no question. He was wrong. He was imagining improvement and success with Scientology where there had been none." All of Hubbard's senses were painfully acute. Each day, every room he inhabited had to be dusted to the point that it would pass a white glove test. He was fanatically clean, but also hypersensitive to soap, so that his clothes had to be rinsed up to 15 times. And even then he would complain that he could smell the detergent. His chef had to switch from cooking on stainless steel to Corningware because Hubbard complained of the taste of metal in his food. These stories were traded among his disciples as more evidence of his superhuman powers of discernment. According to several Sea Org members, while he was in Las Palmas, Hubbard fell in love with another woman, Yvonne Gillam, the ship's public relations officer. She would later go on to start the Celebrity Center in Hollywood. She had a wide smile, large hazel eyes, and a short pixie haircut bearing a resemblance to Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music. Gillam combined a down-to-earth personality with a touch of class that came from growing up in the high society of Queensland, Australia. Inevitably, Hubbard demanded that she accompany him on the high seas. Gillam had three young children at St. Hill, and she had only joined the Sea Org on Hubbard's pledge that they could stay with her, but Hubbard's desire for her had become a prison, one that she was too loyal to escape. Hubbard was 56 years old in the fall of 1967 when he set sail with his youthful crew. There was no destination or purpose other than to wander. Hubbard was by now portly, ruddy-faced, and jowly. His swept-back, once-red hair had turned strawberry blonde. His eyes, which had been described as blue or green by various observers, were actually gray, like seawater, casting an odd flatness over his aspect. Two strong lines transected his face, a deep furrow between his eyebrows matching the notch below his nose and the cleft in his chin, and his duckbill lips, which were his most prominent feature. Once aboard, he dressed in various naval uniforms befitting his self-appointed station as Commodore of the fleet, with lots of braid and crossed anchors on his cap. There were three ships in Hubbard's Navy. In addition to the Avon River, there was a schooner called the Enchanter and the 3,200-ton flagship, a flat-bottom cattle ferry originally called the Royal Scotsman, which was renamed the Royal Scotman because of a clerical error in the registration. The smokestack was emblazoned with the initials LRH. Hubbard spent most of his time in the air-conditioned captain's cabin on the promenade deck of the Royal Scotman, surrounded by windows to take in the ocean vistas. He rarely drank on the ship, except perhaps to take the chill off on a cold night on the bridge. Drugs were nowhere in evidence. His days were largely solitary, passed in auditing himself and writing policy papers. His office on the top deck was called the research room. It was behind a pair of highly polished wooden doors with brass handles. The floor was a bright red linoleum covered with oriental rugs. There was a massive mahogany desk and a huge mirror above a fireplace. Crew members passing by on the upper deck could see him writing with his usual rapidity on foolscap, using a green pen for policy bulletins and a red one for the tech, that is, his vast corpus of coursework and procedures that comprised Scientology's spiritual technology. His restless leg would be jiggling as his hand raced across the page faultlessly in handsome, legible script. For other writing, he turned back to his typewriter. "I think he was doing automatic writing," said Jim Dincalci, one of his medical officers. "The pages would be flying. When he came out of it, he would blink his eyes as if coming awake, and he did this thing with his lips, smacking." Hubbard and Mary Sue would dine in his office between 8 and 10 p.m. Sometime after 3 in the morning, Dincalci would give Hubbard a massage and he would go to sleep. After that, everyone on the ship had to be quiet until Hubbard awakened sometime before noon and remain absolutely mute while he was auditing himself on the e-meter. In Hubbard's opinion, the device operated just below the level of conscious awareness. It somehow knew what you were thinking before you did. It was eerily compelling. Anything that registered on the meter was seen as being significant. The trick was divining what the needle was saying. Sometimes the reaction was so violent that the needle would pound back and forth like a berserk windshield wiper. You could hear it snapping against the pins at either end. Hubbard called this a rock slam. Anyone who registered such a reaction was deemed psychotic and certain to have committed crimes against Scientology. If that person was in the Sea Org, he would be punished automatically, the crime to be sorted out later. After initially resisting the concept of past lives, Hubbard became passionately interested in the subject. "We come back," was the motto of the Sea Org. Hubbard began recalling many of his own previous existences, which the e-meter validated. He claimed to have been a contemporary of Machiavelli's, and he was still upset that the author of The Prince stole his line, "The end justifies the means." He said he had been a marshal to Joan of Arc and Tamburlaine's wife. He told stories about driving a race car in the alien Markab civilization millions of years before. He came to believe that in some of his past lives on this planet, he had buried treasure in various locations, so he launched an expedition to unearth his ancient hoards. He called it the Mission into Time. He selected a small crew to go on the Avon River. Because he wanted to keep the mission secret, he had two long rafts fashioned, which could be rowed ashore under cover of darkness and pulled up on the beach near where he imagined his ancient treasure was buried. When Hannah Eltringham saw she wasn't on the list, she wrote Hubbard pleading to be included, saying she would be willing to perform any duty. To her surprise, Hubbard appointed her chief officer. One very dark, overcast night in 1968, the Avon River dropped anchor on the western coast of Sicily in the bay of Castellammare del Golfo, beside a steep promontory topped by an ancient watchtower. Hubbard gave his missionaries a treasure map he had drawn up based on his past life recollections. The crew set out in one of the rafts toward the rocky shoreline, lugging ropes, shovels, and metal detectors. Giggling and tripping over each other, they scrambled up a 10-foot cliff. It was so dark they couldn't see more than a foot in front of their faces. Each had a hand on another's shoulder as they picked their way through stands of cactus along the rocky outcropping. At one point, the leader of the expedition bumped into a cow. The cow started mooing, then a dog barked, and a light went on in a house nearby. Everyone stood dead still until the scene quieted down. Finally, the clouds parted enough for the moon to shine through. The missionaries found some old bricks they thought might have been the ruins of a castle beside the watchtower. The metal detectors found nothing. Hubbard decided to come along the next day to inspect the site himself. "Yes, yes, this is the place," he said excitedly. He explained the absence of treasure by saying that it must have been hidden in a portion of the ruined castle that had fallen into the sea. The expedition moved on to Sardinia, where Hubbard claimed to have had an affair with the priestess in a temple. "Liaisons in the moonlight," he told his enchanted missionaries, when he was a Carthaginian sailor. "We had a lot of good-looking girls in Carthage, but they didn't come up to her." The Avon River next stopped in Calabria, on the toe of Italy, where Hubbard had buried gold in his days as a tax collector in the Roman Empire. None was found, however. Near Tunis, where the missionaries hoped to dive on the ruins of an ancient underwater city, Hubbard found fault with the captain of the Avon River, Joe Van Staden, and booted him off the ship. Eltringham was sitting at her desk on the tween deck when Hubbard called her into his office and told her she was the new captain of the 400-ton trawler starting in the morning. Eltringham went back to her desk and put her head in her hands. She was 26 years old. Everything she knew about sailing she had learned from Hubbard. To his credit, he had been a good teacher. He had taken a dozen members of the original Sea Org crew and taught them the semaphore code, how to navigate using a sextant, and basic laws of the sea. But she knew nothing about running the engine room or operating the electronics on the bridge or docking a ship. Half an hour later, Hubbard stuck his head out of his office and beckoned to her. He was holding an e-meter. Standing in the doorway where everyone could see them, Hubbard handed her the cans. Then he screwed up his eyes and demanded, "Recall a time you were last a captain." As Eltringham closed her eyes and began to free associate, Hubbard watched the needle on the e-meter. "What's that?" he asked when the needle suddenly dropped. "That was sometime on a ship somewhere, and the ship was sinking," Eltringham responded. "Okay, go back earlier." A moment later, he asked her again, "What's that?" "That's just a lot of confusion. I'm in a cabin with a lot of other people. Something urgent is going on." Hubbard asked her to talk more about it. Eltringham began to see the incident more clearly. "We were in some kind of spaceship," she said. "We were under attack and, oh my God, I can see a planet down there, and the planet's on fire, and something is shooting at us, and, oh my God, the spaceship exploded." Hubbard asked her to tell the story several more times to destimulate the incident. Then he asked Eltringham how she was feeling. "I'm fine, sir." Hubbard screwed up his eyes again. "Do you have any other thoughts about it?" Eltringham realized that he was looking for a floating needle, but she wasn't able to give it to him. Okay, one more question. Are you a loyal officer? I don't know what you mean by that, Eltringham said. I'm loyal to you, and I'm an officer. Hubbard said, All right, that's as far as we'll go this time. Eltringham walked up on the deck and tried to take in what Hubbard meant. Suddenly it came to her. Hubbard wasn't talking about the present. He was referring to the time in her visualization. Some catastrophe must have happened. Eltringham realized that it must have been her planet that was being attacked, and she had been trying to save it. A few minutes later, Hubbard came up on deck and stood beside her. She turned to him and said, Yep, you're right, sir. I was a loyal officer. I am. Hubbard beamed.